I am talking with Sarah from Tomato Nation. I guess I should say the American way, Tomato Nation. Probably nobody has ever heard of Sarah. She doesn't like it when I say this, but I don't think she's really very well known. I don't think her blog has a whole lot of traffic. Her blog, in fact, which you can go and have a look at, is kind of like a fan template from WordPress. It's like not even really like well designed. And Sarah's going to be mad at me for saying all this stuff, but the amazing thing that Sarah does year after year is there is a giving challenge on called Donors Choose. And Sarah comes along and just destroys all of the technology guys with donations. Like, she puts together, through her little blog with not much traffic, she just blows away all the other guys combined. So I think Sarah's got a big story to tell, and I'm fascinated here. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me and my tiny blog with no traffic.
Well, and so let's talk about that. So tiny blog with no traffic. When I look at your blog, now you get a lot of comments, but when I look at your blog, you have an Alexa rank of about 230,000 as of right now. Now, obviously, those can be stored and inflated and all that sort of stuff, but that would generally indicate a blog that has a few thousand visitors a month. Am I wrong?
Well, it depends on the metrics that you're using, of course. The ones that I use show that I'm getting 25,000 to 30,000 unique users a month. I don't really do anything with search engine optimization or try to juice my keywords or anything like that. I probably should do those things, but I really don't. I launched the blog in 97, so I've been around since the internet was in. Yeah, in
short. Was there even an internet back then?
Yeah, we used a chalkboard, and we just mailed
it
to each other. Yeah, we wound it up with Crank. Yes,
Okay.
I also was a co-founder of a much larger site called Television Without Pity, which was a television review site that got more like 1 million unique users a month. And so if I am known at all anymore, it would probably be from that. But Tomato Nation is much more of a boutique site, I guess, a niche. And it's also a holdover really from 10 years ago when no one called it blogs. It was, you know, you had a site or a journal. And I was much more of a generalist and wrote about just about everything culture related. And I have an advice column and I tell stories about my cats. And it really, I mean, dated is not, the right word perhaps, but it's a holdover from a more generalist time on the internet when websites were a little more like print media and tried to be a little more more things to more people kind of thing, instead of being a little more niche and a little more marketed or target marketed.
So just in terms of traffic, you're saying 25 to 30,000 visitors per month, and so daily, we're talking daily like under 1,000 visitors a day.
Yeah, if you average it out, that sounds about right. I think there are spikes, you know, the weekends quiet, and then Fridays, people come in to read the advice column because that's one where I solicit opinions from the readers, so they tend to come in and sit on the site for longer.
And by comparison, we can talk some of the specifics and the numbers, and this is what I find hilarious and impressive. So Craig Newmark, who runs Craigslist, I don't even know what the traffic is, but you know they measure their traffic in billions of page views.
Sure.
In the most recent round of Donors Choose, Craig was able to raise $13,850 from 13 donors, and Tomato Nation with Sarah was able to raise, I don't have the number here, it was $374,036 from 1,132 donors.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Craig,
if you compare the numbers that Gawker Media put up, and this is, you know, all of their sites, I think it's a similarly lopsided comparison.
Now, I mean, Craig didn't put his Donors Choose King page on every page of Craigslist, so he didn't have the visibility that, I mean, you work at this, obviously.
Yeah.
Gawker Media, did they put it up on every page of Gawker Media's site?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, I think it was on all the sites in the sidebar, but I think they didn't do as much to promote it. I mean, I can't speak to what Deadspin did to promote it, but that's not really in their purview. I mean, that's a sports site, and I think it's not, I don't know, it's not branded.
Yeah, what that's what we want to talk about, like how you actually work about it, because while this is giving, I'm of the strong opinion that this can be just applied equally to business, and I think there's a lot of things that we can learn what you're doing here and apply them to business. So Fred Wilson, for example, rockstar VC blogger in New York City, his results were... He raised $38,733 from 217 donors. So that
not
means...
Bad.
Yeah, no, he doubled what he's done before. But still, you know, one-tenth of what you've been raising. And the other interesting... I worked out the numbers. Were your average donation size per person was something like $330, and his is $178.
Right. I'm not sure that number is going to be entirely accurate, because I do have a few angels in the group that donate a much larger... donated a large proportion. That I had one angel who I think provided matching funds in the amount of this year $27,000. I had one.
Well,
before
we go into all the strategy on that, we'll go through that. I'm just talking like overall your average donation size.
Right.
Now, I was a bit embarrassed on. I mean, I donated on Fred one and I get $100, and now I'm seeing like the average donation size is $178, and then on yours it's $330. So okay, they're skewed up by some people giving more money, but now I'm feeling like a little bit of a loser.
Right.
So well, my apologies, I mean, and I'll do better next year.
Well, I think there's no need to apologize, because my part of my whole sales strategy every year is to remind people that in the case of this particular charity, even $5 will make a difference. And I want to get everyone involved and make everyone feel like their $5 or $500, but even $5 will make a difference, and that people shouldn't do that thing Americans sometimes do where they're like, I'm not going to vote because it doesn't matter. Well, you know, right. If everyone thinks that, then it doesn't. So that's part of what I do, is kind of give everyone in the readership ownership of the project and yeah. make everyone feel, because it's true also, and make everyone feel that if we don't all do this together, it can't be done without everyone.
Right. So before we go down that path, can we just take a couple steps back? And could you tell us firstly a little bit about yourself and your blog, and then about Earnest Choose and why you support it? So we can put everything in context, and I'd really love to dig into your strategies, if that's right.
Sure. I'm a writer and editor. I went to Princeton University and graduated with a creative writing degree, which is exactly as useful as you might assume, and worked various odd jobs before the internet presented a better option for me in terms of getting my work out there. It was very difficult for me to break into print. So 15 years ago, when I was getting started, I started up a little website and just put my thoughts down, and it was a way of keep the writing muscles warm, and you know, while I was at the same time making money by being a records clerk, very glamorous. Try not to be jealous. And then
did
I.
Did you show your print degree to get that job?
I did not. I just had to type really fast. God bless the union. So after that, I sort of was building up various online presences, and my pretty much day job, if you want to call it that, I worked at home, but my day job was Television Without Pity for close to 10 years. I did that with two Canadian partners. And that was my main focus, was television and pop culture, and then I was freelancing as a result of that for MSNBC.com and various other publications online and off. And then we sold that site to Bravo a couple of years ago, God bless. And so that's my sort of work history on the Internet. Tomato Nation, which is my own blog, was not sold, and I've continued to update that regularly for over a decade. Jeez.
So what's Tomato Nation about?
Tomato Nation isn't really about any one particular thing. I sort of wanted to be a humor writer, and it was something that I could do. So I started out writing humorous essays once a week, and then I was dared to start an advice column 10 years ago, so I did it as a joke. Because all the other advice columns were so bad, and I thought, you know, well, how hard could this be, and why are they always screwing up, but, you know, and why is Van Lander such an idiot? And then it's actually a lot harder than it looks. But it has an advice column.
That's one of the things that I noticed. Tomato Nation isn't really about anything, right? You're just talking, it's your personality coming across and just talking about stuff you like. Is that
Yeah, well, I prefer to think that it's about everything.
Right.
I like to put a positive spin on it, but yes, it's not, there isn't a niche. There are certain things that I don't really do. I mean, I don't talk about tech, really, but I mean, there are things it doesn't do. But there is not a branded focus, except that there does tend to be a lot of salty language and making fun of celebrities for driving drunk and that kind of thing, but, you know.
Can you tell us, like, the work that you did to develop your template? I mean, you must have paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to get your site design done.
When I first started writing the site, and it was paid on Sprynet. Like, this is going back. I mean, the site is old. And it had no design then either. I had to hand code all the HTML, and I used to call it the fastest loading site on the internet. It was no graphic, it was nothing, you know. I think visual interest and a good design is wonderful and important, but it's not why people come to Tomato Nation, so I just hadn't focused on it. As long as the text is relatively readable and people can find everything pretty much, then.
Well, I mean, I'd like to congratulate you, because it doesn't seem to me like you took the standard WordPress theme, the default one, you changed the color to red. Would that be a fair summary of your...
Yes, I believe I also altered the font somewhat.
Okay.
And that's
good job. Now, and but then
we call focusing on core business and not wasting time on other things.
No, I agree. I mean, there's a guy named Eric Ries who's talked about developing startups and starting with the core stuff and not getting caught up in everything that doesn't make a difference. No question whatsoever.
It's really just a laziness on my part, I will admit. But it's also, that is not important.
You make a blog post, and you've got 200 responses to it.
Something's working. It might not be the design, but apparently that's not all that important.
So tell me then, where's your traffic coming from? Are you like Twitter maniac? Are you doing like hardcore SEO, like you're out there competing with the Viagra guys for traffic? And, you know, you have millions of people on your email list. Like, where's it all coming from?
It's just coming from, what's the word I want? Endurance, I guess. Duration of time. I think that when I first started, I had 3 readers, and 2 of them were blood relatives. And eventually someone forwards it, and so on and so forth. And then I did pull a lot of traffic off of the larger television site for a while. But I think it's mostly reliability, that people do know that there's going to be new content of some kind at least a couple of times a week. I do have a Twitter account. I do have a Facebook account for the site, but that was, you know, the site predated that, and it's, you know, these are things that everyone has now, but has.
But do you think initially people spent out actually from your television show and that's what gave it a boost and then they kept coming back?
Initially, no. Actually, I met my partners on the television site through Tomato Nation, and that we were all members of this bulletin board that was devoted to TV. But I think it was just a slow accruing of people who would have had one of the articles forwarded to them, and then they saw some things they liked in the archives and stuck around. I really haven't done mailing lists. I haven't done SEO. It's mostly just kind of waiting for the flight to quality, I guess, hopefully. Knock wood. I mean, again, this site started in 97, so the way that you promoted yourself was much different. And then, you know, I've adopted certain...
You're like the internet equivalent of an Amish farmer compared to some of the guys that I talk to. I mean, it's incredible. Congratulations on making it work. It's amazing.
Oh, well, thank you. It's like, you know, some people still like to use a manual typewriter, and that's kind of my emotional wavelength.
So what is it? I mean, are people bookmarking a site, or are they... I mean, when you make a blog post and you have 200 comments to it, where are all those people finding out? I mean, do they bookmark you and know, like, oh, I want to go and write a response every Friday because it's the advice column, or is it
I think... I think for some people that's true. I think, you know, again, every time I have a new entry, it does go out on the Twitter stream. It does go out on the Facebook update. And then people retweet it or whatever, however it is they're spreading it. But I think regular readers, either I'm on bookmarks list or I'm on a reader aggregate stream, or it's just part of their daily tour, or they click on it out of Twitter. I don't know where they always come from. I think at this point I do have a regular readership. I also have different readerships for different things. There are people that only read what I write about baseball and don't care about any of the rest of it. There are people who only read the advice column and were not aware that I even wrote anything else because they only come in through that link and they never go to the homepage. So I have, you know, on top of having a loyal demographic, I also have some sub-demographics, I believe. I haven't done any sort of formal information collection about this.
I mean, is the majority of your readership women?
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah, because I mean, as a guy, I haven't found it as a site that I can particularly get into a lot. It's yeah, it doesn't. I mean, and I guess it's like Sex in the City. I know people like it, but it's.
Well, that's the same way with Sex in the City. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what I mean. When I'm writing about baseball, then there's a big chunk of the demographic that doesn't care because, you know, for better or worse, a lot of women don't give shit about baseball. A lot of men don't either, actually. If I were writing about the NFL, That'd be different because everybody likes football.
So explain to me, you publish a post out, like what is a post that is going to get 200 comments on it, and why is that happening? I mean, it seems to me is that because you're strong in writing and you write in a very emotional way that you have such a strong connection with your readership that they feel like it's all a team. And then because you all feel like you're a team, then you all want to just, you know, sit around the coffee table and chat in the comments, that therefore you build effectively a community through it's not really a forum. It's a fairly limited community platform. But then because you've built that sub-community and there is that connection there, that when you go and do something like Donors Choose, you get cast.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that having run a much larger site, which did have a community bulletin board for a very long time, and having seen kind of the best and worst of what that could generate in terms of behavior and the sense of community, I do have some rules for commenting. I do check every comment before it goes through. I'm trying to keep the conversation a conversation and not have, spam, but also people in all caps being rude to each other, yelling. I mean, you know, salty language is fine. Obviously, I use it constantly. And strong opinions are fine, and disagreeing with me absolutely is fine. But I'm trying to have it be a discussion and a debate and not just a way out of whack signal to noise ratio like you may see elsewhere where the comments aren't moderated as closely. A post that gets a lot of comments does tend to be, you know, I'm not going to lie, I have two cats. It's part of the spinster code. And any post about cats or, like, joking about cat behavior or I ran this one thing that pretended to be this anthropological study about the cats, and people on the internet love that, and they love to tell their own stories about their cats or their dogs or their ferrets or whatever. That gets a lot of comments. Making a bold statement on a point of etiquette on which you know you're outdated but you feel very strongly also will get a lot of comments. Cotkeep.org linked to this essay I wrote a few years ago saying, look, I don't care if you don't want to do it. You're writing me a goddamn thank you note. I'm not buying you anything else. That's how that's going to go. You can like it. You can not like it. And a lot of people really didn't like it and accused me of being a, you know, fascist and, you know, who are you to decide what people do with their time and you're not Emily Post and fuck you, boo. But I mean, it gets a lot of traffic, something like that, where you take a position and, you know, I don't write posts with the traffic in mind. I write about what I want and sometimes it strikes a chord and people are actually in an argument in the comments right now about whether Sean Penn is a good actor. You know, that wasn't my intent. I was just reviewing this movie and then people have strong opinions about it, but.
So who are you reading? Are they people like you?
I think sometimes yes and sometimes no. Demographic profile anecdotally would suggest that there are a lot of white ladies in their 30s who have cats, but those are just the people who comment. It's hard to say. I think that there may be a large silent majority in that, you know, my baseball posts, like, I love baseball. I presented papers on baseball. I really would love to get into that more as a career option. But I think that people do read those posts and forward them, but I don't think there's as much commenting on them. But that's a whole other sort of sociology of the internet question that I'm actually not qualified to answer. So, but,
right.
You know,
so
the short answer is it depends.
So how much do you actually raise each year with your fundraising trust?
Each year, it's been building each year. I've been doing it it's over the course of 5 years. I've had 4 fundraisers, and I believe my lifetime total is something close to $580,000.
$580,000, you're right. And I noticed you put Google AdSense on the site.
Yeah.
Are you able to talk about your revenues from Google AdSense?
Oh, can you put the word revenues in quotes? Because not
yeah, no, I mean,
so
you know, let's be real.
Yeah, they don't bother paying until you've made $100. So it covers my hosting expenses. Let's leave it at that. It gets me to break even.
Well, we don't want to break the terms of service of the Google AdSense publisher agreement because then
they are a little. I think technically I'm not even allowed to admit that. I have them.
So you're
supposed to mention it on the blog. Like, oh well, okay. It's like being
you're actually making millions of dollars through those AdSense ads, and you know, not be telling us here.
Yeah.
No, I think it's incredible. So let's talk about how you do it. So. I mean, actually, can you tell us a little about Donors Choose and why you support that, and then maybe why you think your community supports that? I think we're getting a picture that you build community, people are connected, they feel connected with you, you're their leader. You build a tribe. Have you read the book about tribes?
Yes.
Okay,
I built a tribe. I heard about Donors Choose by reading about it in The New Yorker in 2004, for those of you who aren't familiar. It was founded by a former New York City public school teacher in response to the fact that teachers generally were underfunded. Like, teachers in low-income schools didn't have enough money to do they didn't have enough money for basic materials at times. They were running out of paper. They all had to share one copy of the textbook, or it had to be photocopied and then they're out of paper. They needed air purifiers. They needed desks. And there was no money in the budget. This wasn't something that the local PTAs could provide. Donors Choose a system is to solicit project proposals from a teacher. And then the teacher posts this proposal. For example, I need, you know, 50 reams of paper for my class. It costs $500. And then donors can donate the entire $500 and pay for the entire project. They can donate $50. They can donate $5. And then you immediately see a difference on the proposal's page that you have made this donation and that it is going directly to the classroom. You're not writing a check to, for example, World Wildlife Fund. And, you know, your $500 probably goes into mailing materials asking you for even more money. It's a much more direct system. It's all on the internet. I mean, of course, they have a brick-and-mortar office, but it's all on the internet, and it's addressing need directly.
One of the things that I found interesting talking to some of the Donors Choose, I talked to some of the Donors Choose teachers, and they were very clear that it's their stuff. Like, if they move to another school, they take it with them. And, like, it's not in the school system. It's outside. And that sort of gives the teachers a little bit more control to be able to help their kids. Which I found an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, and I think that that's important also because the teachers do feel – at least my sense when I first got involved with the charity is that the teachers just felt completely powerless to affect any change. And on top of that, it was at a point in American politics where Bush II, you know, had made a bunch of promises about No Child Left Behind. And I think the net result of that was that there was a lot more testing and a lot more fighting over social grade promotion and not much funding and not much attention paid to how children really learn and what they need to do that. I am the product of Town University, 17 years of private schooling that my parents were able to pay for in full. I had every possible advantage, and my education was made a big priority by my parents, and they were able to give that to me, which I'm very grateful for. But many, many people in this country don't have that and are forced to rely on public schools to educate their kids, and the public schools would like to do that, but they're not able to, and certainly there are no extras. Whole schools without arts programs, whole schools without certain books that we took for granted, and, you know, they have to pass around one book among 40 kids. And I just thought, you know, since I have been lucky in this way, and since this is clearly a need, that I think a small investment in something like this pays off really big down the road for the entire society. And I found it very attractive. And, you know, getting back to the fact that Tomato Nation is not designed at all, DonorChoose.org, their website is, you know, functional. It doesn't look like it's from the past or anything like that, but when I first got involved with it, it was very stripped down. Like, the navigation was and still is pretty basic. You're only given the links that you need, and it's it's not a lot of flash on it. It's not a lot of bells and whistles. It's trying to give you the information that you need, and it's not taking a lot of time with extras. And I found that very appealing, sort of as a small business person and as a donor, that I felt like there was not a lot of fat on it.
Right.
I felt like it was run with an eye towards doing, you know, just sort of 95% doing what it was designed to do, which was to get resources to teachers and to public school kids, and not staffing around with, like, let's have this benefit and let's do a concert.
So can we talk a little bit about then about how this actually works? So you do one fundraising drive per year, is that right?
Yes.
So when do you start driving, and why at what particular time? Why do you pick that time?
Well, I actually didn't pick that time. I have to go back a little bit. The first year that my readers and I were involved with this was around the presidential elections in 2004. And whatever everyone else's politics are, I don't judge you, but Bush's reelection was a grave disappointment to me and to many of my readers who are political progressives. And people were writing into the advice column, actually, and saying, how do I manage the next 4 years when I feel like I don't belong in this country? And, like, I don't share
value. So, how many of your readers are Bible Belt bumpers and conservative Bush voting, gun-carrying types of people?
Based on the comments, none. We do have some current and ex-military who sometimes have a different perspective on certain decisions, but as far as the commenting goes, I mean, I'm happy.
So that's another thing, and that's an important thing to identify. You've been picked. You've got a very strong theme through your group. Like, I mean, it is very much a group that identifies together.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think that there are some people who will take an outlying position, but in terms of politics, I've made it very clear through one of my more popular essays, actually, that I am a progressive, social progressive, fiscal conservative feminazi, and I'm really not trying to hear any sexist language, or, you know, I'm pro-gay marriage and pro-choice, and other people's beliefs are other people's beliefs, but would that make certain readers uncomfortable? Yes, that's possible. I can live with it. You know, it's not... It's not value judgment. It's just, it is what it is. But that
okay, so when, the, when do you do your fundraising issue? When do you start?
It's in October. This is why I need to back up. When I first began this drive, it was in response to feeling powerless to affect anything as progressive. So I invited my readers to donate to
Bonus
Soup.
So the donations are actually in response to the political environment?
Initially they were, because a big part of the reader's frustration with Bush is that he presented it as this anti-intellectual politician who really had no interest in education or in keeping promises about education. And in response to that feeling of powerlessness and frustration and why don't we all just move to Canada, I said, listen, I just read about this organization where you can give some money directly to a public school classroom and you can make a difference and you can feel like you exist in the system. So that's how that started. After that, I believe we raised $23,000 that time. In response to that, I was invited into the donors' offices to tell them how I had managed to do that. I didn't really have a ton of answers for them at that time, but then Donors Choose decided to launch what they then called the Blogger Challenge, and what is now called the Social Media Challenge, that would take place every October, and from October 1st to October 31st, it would be kind of a throwdown between all these various blogs.
That comes along with that. You know, it's you know, the guys, like, really feature it, and it's fascinating to see because there's all these small numbers, and then along comes you.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I don't think that I necessarily, invented this idea, but I think that it was interesting to see, because for a nonprofit that was based pretty much entirely in the online space, they seemed sort of shocked that another online space actually leveraged that in a way that made a lot of sense. I mean, we couldn't necessarily figure out exactly why so much money had been given, and, you know, Bush is not going to be reelected every year, so how am I going to do this next year? But I think that they realized at that point that if one blog can earn all this money, there's a bajillion blogs out there. If you set it up as a kind of a competition with the leaderboard and give it kind of a contest festival atmosphere, then you can really leverage it. And there was, I think the first year they did it, I was sort of talking a lot of shit about Fred Wilson, who, you know, what he's doing is great, and I obviously had nothing against the guy personally, but it made it more fun to be like, well, you know, Fred Wilson thinks that he can challenge our fundraising abilities, and I don't think you guys should put up with that crap. So how about everybody cuts up another $10 and shows Fred Wilson his boss? And then we also... killed Stephen Colbert that year, and he had a TV show and mentioned his bride on the show and still shits on him. So who knows? It's kind of this miraculous weird.
So that's actually another theme for like fundraising or you know, potentially making money and other stuff as well, is you've created a common enemy. So you've got one through the political system with Bush, and then you've got a second one there with Fred, who obviously I know as well, and I've interviewed, and I think he's a great guy.
Fred,
you obviously like him too.
Yeah, well, Fred, certainly the first year Fred emailed me and was like, I see that you're killing us. Who the hell are you? And I said, well, you know, I'm kind of nobody, you know. But at this point, I mean, at this late date in my fundraising career with this group of readers in this particular organization, a lot of it is just, I would almost say, muscle memory. Like, the readers know that this will happen every year. They give up their pennies. They take great pride in dusting the competition. And so I don't have to always work that hard to sell it to them at this point because they know what it is. Last year,
do your readers actually save up for this?
I think some of them do, no.
So it's actually pretty important to them?
Yeah. I mean, it's become something of an institution in the sense that they are part of this thing that is bigger than they are. And that they are, I think they feel relied upon by me, by Donors Choose, by the other competitors. But, you know, for this year, I did offer to remove myself from the competition. I said, I'll still raise money at another time of year, but don't you think that maybe this might be getting a little depressing for other participants? But, you know, Donors Choose felt that it was an inspiration, it was a motivation for other participants. I actually don't know how true that is. I wouldn't know how to gauge that. I was
no,
sort of flexible on doing what I felt.
You set the pace. You can't pull out. There's no way you can do that. I mean, you've
I don't know how I'm going to top 350 grand next year. And that is
you'll do it by getting half a minute.
We'll see. I didn't give myself good odds this year, but for some reason, I just had faith that the money would come from somewhere, that if I asked, it would appear. It was kind of field dreams, faith.
Yeah, you're doing this down home, like, laid bad angle on it, but, I mean, let's be real here. You do a lot of work, you do a lot of posts about it, and then you have a lot of bonuses which you give away when people donate, don't you? I mean,
yes.
Can you maybe explain some of that stuff and what I'm kind of thinking and how that works?
Well, I sort of do the fundraiser in the framework of a contest, which is actually how it started, that I do a contest every year, people can win things, and so that's how that started, was forward me your Donors Choose receipt, and that will be your entry into the contest. And I think that people do enjoy getting free stuff, and people also enjoy contributing free stuff, so that's a whole other angle or a whole other way that people can help with the contest, but that's kind of an excuse at this point. I feel like a lot of the readers don't care whether they win anything. They feel like they've already won. The Donors Choose setup and the feedback that you get from the teachers and the students is extremely touching and rewarding for people, and I feel like for some of them, if I give them, you know, a copy of Civilization IV on CD-ROM or the tickets to something or other, like, they appreciate it, but it's no longer why they're participating. They're not participating to win prizes. But
so why are they participating? I mean, is it part of a movement that you've got? I mean, maybe you're going to be politicians in this? Like, what's...
I'd like to think no. I don't know that it's a movement necessarily, but first of all, part of it is just that logistically speaking, during the month of October, if you're not part of the contest and following the contest, then you're kind of going to feel left out of what's going on the blog. So part of it is that community aspect.
So the blog is, you've taken a blog that people follow, and you've taken your community, and as a leader, you turn it into the contest. So that's the first thing. You want to pay attention
to
the motivation.
Yeah, well, for the month of October, it definitely is a contest, and I do occasionally have to apologize to readers who, for whatever reason, don't have much interest in it and say, you know, more regular programming will resume on 1st of November, but until then, you know, we have kids who are counting on us, and let's buy these books, and occasionally put up a movie review just so that people don't, you know, go away forever and not come back.
And what are they talking about in the comments during the time when you're running the promotion?
They're talking about, they're mentioning specific projects that they'd like to be funded that are either from the area where they grew up, or it's a subject matter that interests them, or it's a former teacher there sometimes. They're talking about how far ahead we are of everyone else, or what proportion of the total fundraising we've done, and who is, you know, making a run at trying to attack us. They're talking about the letters that they receive from the classroom and how touching those are. They're talking about just logistical things, like, you know, I can't find a certain project. Did I donate to the right place? No. And then they're talking to each other, I think. But that's part of...
Do your readers build a relationship with each other, or is it all just a one-way relationship with you?
I think they build a relationship with each other. I think that, you know, there's certain... I call them the Tomato Street irregulars that, you know, you see the same names over and over again, and you definitely recognize them. And then there are some only occasional commenters, but I think that part of it is a feeling of community, both within the contest and generally on a blog, that you do have some regular posters who are known to each other. I don't know if they socialize, like, apart from me. They're welcome.
And, I mean, have you ever, like, had people come meet face to face anyway?
I've done that a couple of times. I had a little baseball watching conference and gave some stuff away and actually raised a little money for Donors Choose doing that. I'm thinking of doing a much larger meetup. And then whenever I do my stunt, the other thing about the fundraiser is that I always promise to do some crazy thing. I'll dress as a tomato, obviously. I actually bought a tomato outfit and took it as a tomato right off. This is this is how big the contest has gotten in my career life. But people do come out to see me do whatever my stunt is. I do a little dance in Rockefeller Plaza one year, and a bunch of people came out to watch that. And then this year I will be going to Atlantic City dressed as a tomato, so I'm hoping that Philadelphia and South Jersey locals can come out and play a little blackjack and watch me befuddling casino security with my big foam outfit. But, yeah,
so
I have
to... It's part of the competition, so you kind of make it fun as well, like, and make it entertaining for people, and, hey, here's a way to humiliate Sarah, our noble leader, if you give more money to donor shoes.
Right. Well, and you also have to signal to the readers that you believe that much in the project. One year I shaved my head. Like, and not, you know, like down to stubble. I mean, shave it. Skin. And probably caught a cold right afterwards. That lasted for 2 weeks, but, you know, as it turns out, I have a very nice round head, so that part of it actually worked out okay. But I think that in the case of my particular readership, which is not necessarily wealthy people, if there are a lot of graduate students or, you know, college students or people like me who sort of have enough money to get by, but not a lot, to ask them, especially in the last couple of years when the economy has been in the shitter, to ask them to give money to this organization on your say-so, I think that when I signal to them that this is that important to me, that I will shave my head, that I will buy a $300 vegetable outfit, and prance around Washington, D.C., you know, that's important to me. So that's, I think, an article of faith with the readers. I take this very seriously, that I am working extremely hard behind the scenes to keep all the pricing organized, to keep up, make sure all the donations are going where they're supposed to go, to be a liaison, you know, if people have questions about whatever donors choose back in, that I know who to tell them, whom to contact. I definitely don't want them to feel like this is, you know, drudgery or that I'm complaining, but I do need them to know that I'm working hard, that I'm committed to this project, and that their participation is important to me and is matched by full participation and investment of my time and energy on my side. Because at a time like this, where the first element of discretionary spending that people take out at an economic time like this is charitable giving. Frequently, that's the first thing to go, that they can't afford to give to public radio anymore. They're not, you know, fuck you, Sierra Club, like, they have to tighten their belts. And when I come in after the failure of Lehman Brothers, I'm like, I would like you to raise $100,000 for people you don't even know on my say-so. I think that a big part of their trust in me, I mean, you're talking about, is it a movement or am I an institution? I'm sort of not comfortable with terms that big and grandiose to describe what I do, because a lot of what I do is not what I do, it's what the readers do, and it's what the charity does to be, you know, an attractive prospect. But a big part of it is making them feel that this is a public or sort of a community trust. What we do with the fundraiser is community trust. Everyone has to tighten their belts now more than ever, et cetera. And
so that's another point to this. So you're raising 10 times more than Fred Wilson, and, I mean, the net worth of Fred Wilson's community versus yours is probably somewhat different.
Yeah, well, I think you're talking exponents there, probably. I mean, you know, we do have some first-class flyers in the readership, I'm sure. But, you know.
So can you tell us about some of the other dynamics? And you mentioned earlier on the call, we talked about, you have some like someone that came and gave like $27,000 in matching funds. Like, what are some of the other things that are going on to get the numbers to be as high as they are? You're doing the matching donations, you're running around in a tomato outfit. Like, what else is going on?
Well, as I said, I think that by this point, you know, we started doing this in 2004, and now in 2009, I think that there is a muscle memory aspect to it, that the readers are prepared for this to happen in October. They're, you know, looking for projects that appeal to them. They're primed for it. Like, they've been, not trained, that's a little, not super comfortable with that word, but they've been prepared.
Right, so you train them to do it.
And then there's another psychology of crowds aspect. It's kind of a reverse psychology thing where if I imply that, you know, I would really like you to reach 70,000 by today, you probably can't do it, but it would be really great. And if you haven't donated yet, today would be a great day to do that. And then there is usually this small piranhas on a cow type flurry of donations where they feel that I have impugned their honor, and they will then get to 70,000 and show me what's boss. Who's
really?
Boss?
So you actually like put them down a little bit and they want to earn your approval.
Yeah. Or it's more like, you know, it's okay. We're all winners. And they're like, fuck that. we know how to do this. Out of way, crazy lady. We got this. And then putting match points at key points in the fundraiser where experience has shown me that after, for example, the initial excitement, things tend to slow down. After the first big goal, things tend to slow down. Like, once I get to 50, a lot of them sort of sit back and feel like, okay, I've done my part. And that's where you really have to give them the guilt. I mean, this year, my brother and his wife had a baby in June, and my nephew is, by all objective measures, the cutest baby ever born. And I was not afraid to dress him up in little outfits, including the tomato, and put pictures of him on the site and say, this is the future public school students. Do you want him to go without Hemingway in his English class? You cold-hearted bastard, do it for the baby! I mean, shameless. Whatever works. And that did work on a couple of people. He said, you know, I thought I'd empty my pockets with another $10 for the little nipper. So there are a bunch of things that I can do that do work. Some of it comes from having 5 years experience and knowing how this particular crowd will behave and putting incentives at the points where they're needed most, and also just having faith that they can get it done. And that
do you know it's the community in person, or is it just because you've just done it enough times?
I have met various readers at various times. I'm certainly not versed that. It's a lot of fun for me, actually, to meet them in person, especially if they're regular commenters, to be able to put a face with a name is lots of fun. But I don't have regular meetups. It's something I'm thinking of starting in 2010 to try to make it more of an in-person community as well and see if people respond to that. The internet sometimes is its own thing, and it doesn't translate. And my readers are sort of sprayed all over the world. One of my larger donors this year is actually from Norway. So, you know, I guess she feels U.S. public schools are important, and I'm glad she does, but it's not necessarily a centralized or even New York-based community, so I'm not sure how that would work out. But definitely my sense
of... She's in Norway, and she's giving a U.S. public school on your blog, and she's going to be a donor.
I guess you just think I'm a nice gal. I think that
have
is...
Have you ever talked to her by phone?
No. No need. Email. And also the time difference is a little severe. But, that's the amazing thing to me, is the trust that some of these larger donors put in this project, that at least initially it was... you know, something that they did on my CISO, which is a big responsibility.
Now, how does it work with a larger donor? Do they approach you? Do you go out and solicit them? Do you do matching? Like, what's the deal for a bigger donor?
It depends. Usually they've approached me. I have a couple who are in my real life circle that I've approached that I can rely on every year. But the bigger donors really approached me and said, you know, in one case I have a trust that was left to me by my mother for charitable giving. I would like to set up a system this year where if certain projects are donated to, like a certain science project, for example, then I will donate a light amount. But generally speaking, they approach me, and it's often because they want certain projects from a certain part of the country or with certain given subject matter to be addressed, and they want to ensure that extra attention is given to that, and that in my daily posts I say, here are 5 projects that we're focusing on today in Detroit, for example. Donors to this project can receive a special prize, and we will get extra money if these projects are completed. So that's helpful motivationally, that the donors can feel that they can control some of the money, which they can, and then we're given an extra boost. And, you know, these extra boosts create extra boosts of their own. The people are inspired by a big jump in a number to, become a part of it. It builds on itself. So that's very helpful. But I did consider, like, doing a little roadshow this year, because I asked for just a ridiculous amount of money that I had no reasonable expectation would ever be raised. So I was considering working my various contacts and trying to get in front of someone at the Trump organization, or, you know, writing for a grant, doing something to get actual block donations lined up ahead of time just to ensure that we didn't fall short. I didn't end up having time to do that. And as I said before, there was some little voice that said, you know, money will come. And it did. There was a man who wrote to me offering a $20,000 match. I didn't recognize his name. I didn't recognize his internet handle. I'm not sure how he found me, but he made a very generous donation to get us up to $300,000. And whether it's the charity or whether it's the, you know, cult of personality that I've created, I really can't say. But I'm very grateful to him and all my donors, big and small. There were people that gave $1 a day just so they could feel that they were part of it and stretch their participation out throughout the month.
And they come in every day and give a dollar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One donor in particular, she had it set to give $1 a day. Just so that there would be that little bit of momentum, that there would always be a dollar. Because I think she had $3 budgeted for this. It was the best she could do, which, you know. But she wanted to feel like she was part of it every day, and she was. So. It's a.
Is there any other parts that we haven't discussed in terms of how you make this work?
I don't think so. It is a lot of setup work on the front end and then cleanup work on the back end. I think people that I talked to have been a little surprised. I think they're expecting to hear that I have some, like, magic formula or here's how you target your mailing list or what have you, but really it's just sitting on this database for 16 hours a day and writing posts to motivate people and being funny and then being serious and trying to hit the buttons that would get people involved and excited. And there's also the fact that I can't take full credit for any of it. It's an excellent organization that's set up in a way that makes it very easy for me to sell it. It's not obscure. You see a difference immediately. It's an excellent organization, and all I sort of had to do was stand next to it and point at it.
Well, you're doing a little more than that. Actually, I want to just ask, in fact, have you studied traditional copywriting? By that I mean David Ogilvy type stuff, Joe Sugarman, John Cables, Claude Hopkins, any of the traditional copywriting. Have you studied any of that?
I really haven't studied it. I mean, it's sort of the same things that people read in passing, references up there.
But you haven't actively gone out and read books? You haven't gone out and read books on copywriting and print?
No, because, you know, the thing is that I've had an internet presence since I was a child, and it's pretty much learning from experience, both generally speaking, how internet readers tend to respond to things and how my specific readers tend to respond to things, that you have a sense of, I have actually studied Obama's speeches very carefully, and I'm fascinated by how he's able to do certain emotional things the way he does in the writing. I like to sort of turn his speeches over and look at the back and see where the knots are. But that entire process, not just traditional copywriting, but just generally the narrative process and how you get certain effects, it's what I do. I'm a writer. But trying to sort of, I don't want to sound too cynical and like, I'm just trying to take advantage of people. That's obviously not what's happening, but there's a certain way to pitch things that it's based on experience and on understanding how the readers do tend to respond or not respond to certain things.
I'm sorry. I've got to ask you this question because we're wrapping up. And this is probably a question that's going to offend you, but I've got to ask you. Have you ever read any Ayn Rand, like Atlas Shrugged, or any other books?
I got halfway through The Fountainhead, and then I just couldn't anymore. Just couldn't take it.
It would seem to me that if you managed to get that to work with your like mental system, that you would be like one of the best people selling stuff online, because you clearly have got that drive and the understanding of how to sell stuff. And I know some of your readers are going to listen to this interview and they're going to like beating up in the comments on my side and all this stuff. But I don't know. I think you've really got something here. I'm impressed.
No, I see where you're going with it. I think that her writing itself, I couldn't tolerate it. But there's definitely something there. The ability to strike a chord was something she could definitely do. Whatever. You can point to a lot of best-selling writers who. That's true. Everyone does something well. So.
Is there anything you wish to talk about that we have not covered?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, Sarah, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me.